many thanks for the introduction. So today I hope to talk to you about my work on boson stars and kind of show you how my work has developed throughout my PhD. So the outline of this talk will be as follows. So first off, I will just present a brief overview of boson stars and their formulation. Next, I will move on to actual numerical relativity simulations of these boson stars and present initial data that we use for these simulations, which actually plays a crucial role in making our simulations physical. Next, I will present the applications of our initial data to simple head-on collisions of boson stars. And then I will present more, I guess, astrophysically more interesting scenarios of inspiraling boson star systems. And finally, I will look at a hypothetical scenario of a boson star merger occurring somewhere in our universe. And I will talk a little bit more about what would LIGO tell us about it. So let's start with a brief overview. So back in the mid-20th century, Wheeler had this idea that you can actually couple gravitational and electromagnetic fields, and you can form these electromagnetic entities that he called gions. Unfortunately, later on, these gions have been found to be unstable. And a few years later, Kalb decided to go back to this study, and he decided to replace this electromagnetic field with a complex scalar field. And what he actually found that you can form gravitationally bound spherically symmetric configurations made up out of this complex scalar field. And these configurations are nowadays dubbed as boson stars. These boson stars have been studied in cosmological settings as well. They've been, for example, suggested as dark matter candidates. And the common formation challenges for boson stars are through gravitational condensation. So you may all be familiar with black holes and neutron stars, which have become elementary particles of our universe. So what are these boson stars, really? So these boson stars are comprised of some boson particles. They're possibly ultralight. And on the one hand, we have a conserved charge that precludes the gravitational decay. And on the other hand, we have the gravitational attraction that kind of fights back that tendency of the wave packet to disperse. Combining these two ingredients, we form a boson star. And there are in certain regimes, these boson stars can be actually fairly compact, that they can resemble gravitational wave signatures of black holes. And that's why they're often called as black hole mimickers. Also, similar to neutron stars, these boson stars have a maximum mass. And this maximum mass is typically regulated by a potential you're looking into. At the same time, unlike black holes, we don't have a horizon. And unlike neutron stars, these boson stars don't have a surface. So what actually happens is that the scalar field is kind of concentrated around some point, and then it falls off to infinity. So it follows an exponential decay. Now, a natural question you might ask me is, well, why is she studying these hypothetical objects? And the simple answer is, first of all, there's been increased interest in modified theories of gravity and theories beyond the standard model of particle physics. And everyone has been looking in different directions to how we can test general relativity. In one of the branches of that, people have been looking at what we call exotic compact objects. And the idea here is that usually ordinary matter cannot support the very huge self-gravity of a massive and ultra-compact object. So for example, take neutron stars, and if they have a compactness of roughly a third, then they cannot sustain masses larger than 3 solar masses. And usually when we have these massive and ultra-compact objects, they're usually black holes. And the question that is interesting to pose is whether it can be something else. Most importantly, I'm also interested in studying the boson star dynamics and seeing whether we can find smoking gun effects to differentiate boson stars from black holes and neutron stars. So there's been a lot of work done in regards to boson stars. There've been plenty of numerical studies. And many of you may be working on modified theories of gravity, so you're aware there's a whole zoo of modified theories of gravity. Well, there's a whole zoo of boson stars. There exist many codes that study boson stars in the numerical setting. In my case, I use GeoTrombo code, which is an adaptive mesh refinement numerical relativity code. If you have any questions in regards to the code or collaboration, I will be very happy to address them. Okay, so what are these boson stars mathematically? So to form a boson star, you have to take GR and minimally couple a complex scalar field to it. These boson stars usually are characterized by potential. And it's very much analogous to the equation of state for neutron stars. In this talk, I will focus on what we call a solitonic potential, which contains a mass term and a self-interaction term, which we denote by sigma zero. And the reason why we consider this potential is because you can actually get a fairly good range of stars of different compactness, including very compact stars. And kind of the main problem we're trying to tackle here numerically is to solve the set of the Einstein-Klein-Gordon equations. And the first thing that we're going to do is to look at how we can find single boson star solutions to this set of equations. In my opinion, solutions of boson stars to these equations are mathematically very beautiful. So maybe to clarify, I will focus only on spherically symmetric configurations. So for this purpose, I will decompose the complex scalar field into the amplitude and frequency. Additionally, perfect, thank you. Thanks. Additionally, if you've ever looked at boson star literature, sometimes you can see people kind of enriching the parameter space by including a constant dephasing and this epsilon term, which actually changes the rotation of the star in the complex plane. Essentially, when, for example, this epsilon is -1, we call it an anti-boson star. The main quantities that determine a solution here is the amplitude and the frequency. And actually, regular solutions exist for countably infinite number of these frequencies, which satisfy the following relation. So as you find more frequencies, their numerical values increase. And the lowest frequency, with n is equal to zero, actually corresponds to ground states. And as you increase the n, you recover what we call excited states. And what's quite interesting is that this n number corresponds to the number of zero crossings in the amplitude. So this is something that you can see on this plot, which shows the amplitude as a function of radius of the star. And the blue line, for example, doesn't have any crossings, so this is a ground state. On the contrary, the pink line has a 1, 0 crossing, so this is now an excited state of n is equal to 1. In this talk, I will focus only on ground states because excited states have been found to be unstable. Now, if you fix your potential,
Here, potentially, you had a sextic potential, right? It had to start with a pi squared, and then it had a pi to the fourth term when you squared the second thing. So you had two scales in your potential, of mu and sigma.
In this self-interaction, yeah.
How does omega depend on those scales? And kind of why did you need a sextic term rather than just a quartic potential?
The dependence of the frequency, there is a dependence of the frequency on the self-interaction term. The reason why we include this term is that you can usually obtain Bose-Einstein solutions that have high compactness. And if they have high compactness, they're more closer to black holes. So we kind of want to explore both the regimes where, for example, a boson star has a resemblance to a black hole, and the regimes where it's not.
What's the scale of the ground state omega?
In here, do you mean what the numerical value of omega is?
Yeah, if I want to change the value of omega naught, or sigma naught and mu, and what happens? Which way do they go if I start varying mu and sigma naught?
Right. So it depends. For a fixed potential, so for a fixed sigma zero, you can plot, for example, the amplitude as a function of a frequency, depending on what part of the parameter space, this frequency will be different. But usually, for these kind of stars that we're considering here, the frequency is roughly around the values of 0.5 to 0.8.
I'm sorry to be stuck on, but I guess it's there a correlation on the scale of that sigma on the radius of where 90% of your energy lies?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The
dependence is not always like monotonic. Typically, if you decrease your self-interaction term, you can get more compact stars, and they would have different frequencies.
And the more compact the star is it the case that the higher frequency of the fundamental state, your ground state is?
I don't remember from the top of my head. I would have to look at the plot. I don't think I have it in my slides.
Scale, right? So it's smaller than black frequency is higher.
Right. I would have to check that. Right, so for a given potential, you can actually construct a whole family of solutions. And if you have worked with neutron stars before, you might have seen these mass over radius plots. And here I'm just showing you one of the examples of such plots. And a very common feature that you can see here is that this plot attains a maximum mass. Essentially, if you go over this maximum mass, your solutions become unstable. Some of the stars that I've denoted here are one of the few models that we will be considering in our actual numerical simulations. And you can see that, for example, for these sort of potential choice, the maximum compactness you can get is roughly of 0.2. And if you think, well, I'm a little bit crazy for studying these boson stars in general relativity, it gets even better. You can study these boson stars in scalar tensor theories. An interesting phenomenon that occurs there is spontaneous scalarization. And thanks to this phenomenon, you can actually get additional branches in your mass over radius plots. So it really enriches the parameter space that you can explore.
And this is, would you have a second scatter field?
Yeah. But this is not the focus of this presentation, so let's go back to GR. All right, so now we are in the position to construct single boson star solutions. How do we evolve these solutions numerically, and how do we form a binary? So I don't know how people are familiar here with the key concepts of NR, so I will give a very brief overview. So I think typically for humans, it's very hard to think in four dimensions. And typically what we do in numerical relativity is that we foliate our spacetime into spatial hypersurfaces, and we prescribe some sort of time-like direction for evolution. And for example, our spacetime metric is decomposed into a spatial metric. We also prescribe lapse and shift, which essentially allow us to move along the spatial hypersurfaces. In order to understand how our spatial hypersurfaces are embedded in the four-dimensional spacetime, we define extrinsic curvature. And because we are dealing with scalar fields, it's sometimes often to introduce this conjugate momentum, which essentially contains the derivatives of the scalar field. Throughout my talk, you might hear me talk about a conformal factor. A conformal factor is essentially a factor that you introduce to your spatial metric as to kind of absorb all the information about the volume element. So you can conformally rescale your metric with this conformal factor so that the determinant of the resulting metric is one. When you plug in all of your variables into your favorite equations, usually you get a set of evolution equations, which are not very important for now. Additionally, you also obtain constraint equations, which are actually four algebraic equations that have to be satisfied initially and throughout the evolution. And this brings me to, I guess, a nightmare for every single numerical relativist as to how do we prescribe constraint satisfying initial data. In the context of boson stars, for a long time in the literature, people have been using what we call plane superposition. So the idea is that, well, I can construct single boson star solutions. But now I have this issue that I have to construct a binary. So a plausible ansatz to address this can be to simply superpose the metric solutions that you can already construct. And because we like working with asymptotically flat spacetimes, we can also subtract the Kronecker delta function. And this superposition may seem like a good start. However, it causes a range of issues. So first off, in order for me to describe the issues, I will address to this figure over here, which essentially plots the central profile of the scalar field as a function of time. And here, the different colors correspond to different separations. One of the spurious features that you actually observe by using this sort of superposition is that when you consider a binary, before your stars merge, their central amplitude exhibits an oscillatory behavior. So your star is actually not in the equilibrium. Further, you also often get a premature black hole formation. So what I mean by that is that typically when you form a black hole in your numerical simulation, the scalar field suddenly drops to zero. And in certain regimes, you can actually find that you form a black hole right before the stars actually merge. So you can see that this is dashed line, for example, here, corresponds to the time of the common apparent horizon formation. And finally, if you look at the constraint violations throughout your numerical relativity simulation, you can see that they're actually fairly large. Now, you might ask me, well, why is this superposition not working? And the reason is actually fairly simple. So by superposing two solutions, we are perturbing our star solutions from their equilibrium states. And these large deviations from the equilibrium states actually are the causes that are causing these spurious features. And these issues have been actually addressed by Helfer et al., who proposed a kind of a new way of superposing initial data. And the idea was that they needed to account for the influence of one star onto the other by subtracting these metric components. And by subtracting these metric components, they're actually able to recover the equilibrium volume elements around the stars. We later on generalized this superposition to unequal mass binaries. We adopted the same idea of trying to enforce the equilibrium volume elements around the stars. This is a fairly technical aspect, so I'm not going to go into much detail, but I will be happy to answer your questions if you have any.
Yeah. But physically, if you have two objects at some distance, you don't expect to have the equilibrium configuration because there's tidal effects. So, I mean, you would induce some tidal influence on one of the other ones, so you would expect it to be oscillating at its fundamental frequency.
Right. But it wouldn't be the case, for example, when your stars are far from each other.
Gives you something that is more comfortable in the sense that I have something that I know because it's each star is in its equilibrium. Mm-hmm. It's also not realistic.
But if they're sufficiently far apart, they should be in their equilibrium. Yeah. But
they're choosing at a given distance to be as if they were infinite far apart.
Yes, but we can't simulate infinite distances.
And can I have a question?
Yep.
What do you mean by superposition? Because if you are beyond the linear approximation, you cannot have superposition of the solutions in GR.
Yes, that's part of the issues with these superpositions that I'm explaining is that they actually introduce some constraint violations. But when I say superposition, I simply mean just blindly superposing the individual solutions. So these are not the true solutions, as you say, but they are approximations to start from in numerical relativity simulation.
And you are open for an error, probably. Some function to compensate the deviation from superposition principle, right?
Yes.
Have you added a function to your solution to compensate that kind of at first look wrong superposition?
So this is something that is kind of addressed in the superpositions that I just show on the left-hand side, where we partly enforce the equilibrium states of the boson stars at a certain point on the grid. But throughout the, for example, numerical evolution, if you don't get to fix your volume elements correctly, it can induce spurious effects.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so for the methods that I have outlined here on the left, I will refer to them as improved initial data superposition. And actually, there's been even more progress made recently in the literature towards kind of improving our initial data construction. So for example, there have been specific initial data solvers devised to further reduce the constraint violations. There's been actually a study that compared our improved initial data superposition with initial data that was obtained from an initial data solver using a conformal thin sandwich approach. And what they actually found is that, well, of course we can't compete with an initial data solver. However, the differences that you observe by using this superposition and a solution from an initial data solver, it results in fairly small differences of roughly 2%.
That was a large separation, right?
That was a large separation, yeah. And I mean, to be honest, I think to make this study more robust, one would have to span a bigger parameter space and compare how the different initial data performs. So once again, I would like to reiterate that we're using this sort of initial data construction. We don't have an initial data solver yet, but it is something on our plans. Right, so now, once we got the initial data, ideally we would like to do some physics. So let me start with a simple study that we did, including simple head-on collisions. So we have just the two stars boosted towards each other. And what we did is that we wanted to kind of investigate what are the merger dynamics if we introduce this dephasing parameter to one of the stars. So we did this for a range of different mass ratios. So for simplicity, let's start with the equal mass. So what we did is we wanted to investigate we kind of wanted to model the energy as a function of this dephasing parameter. And for equal mass binaries, what this dephasing parameter does is that it actually introduces a constant offset in the dephasing. And what we have found is that the antiphase configuration, which corresponds to delta phi is equal to pi, is most inefficient in gravitational wave emission. So you get least of the energy being emitted. And this effect can be actually attributed to the repulsive nature of the scalar field when this dephasing parameter is pi. On the contrary, the equal phase configuration is the most efficient, so it produces most of the energy. We also repeated a similar study for an equal mass case. So here I'm just showing one of the mass ratios that we have considered. And the role of the dephasing for unequal mass binaries is a little bit more complicated. And the reason is that in an unequal mass binary, you have two stars which oscillate at different frequencies. So they already have a time-dependent contribution to the dephasing. And when we additionally introduce this delta phi parameter, we further change the phase difference. And this usually results in the shift of the energy profiles in the horizontal direction. So now you can see, for example, maxima can occur elsewhere in the delta phi space, so it's no longer the equal phase. And these points here represent our numerical relativity simulations. And if we actually zoom in onto the minima and the maxima, we can actually uncover pretty interesting things. So what we did is we looked at the gravitation wave signal. So in numerical relativity, we use this Psi-4, which essentially measures the gravitational radiation. Here, we have, I'm just plotting 2-0 and the 3-0 modes. On the upper panel, we have the dephasing parameters that corresponds to the minimum of the energy curve. So this is somewhere around here. And what you can see is that the signals themselves, they look very funny. Like they're very reminiscent of the, actually Kip Thorne's drawing back in the days when numerical relativity had to fulfill this merger gap. And clearly in the signals, we see some signatures of tidal deformability. What's even crazier is that L is equal to 3 modes become almost comparable in the amplitudes to the quadrupolar counterparts. Now, if you were to look at a black hole signal for the same mass ratio from the head-on collision, you would have found that the L is equal to 3 mode would have had to be 5 times smaller than the quadrupolar counterpart. At the same time, signals located around the maxima of the energy curve, they exhibit standard black hole features. I mean, if I didn't know that was a boson star head-on collision, I would probably guess it was just two black holes.
But in your previous talk, you were saying there was 14% of the energy of total space-time mass was emitted as gravitational waves. That's like a lot more than a head-on binary black hole collision, right? With that maximum vector.
For the maximum,
Yeah, am I reading that right? For this one on the right, you're saying
yeah.
That was 14% of the space time mass.
Yeah.
That's like a lot more than for
Yeah, I agree. But I guess what I meant is the common feature of a black hole signal containing like a black hole ring down, it's very reminiscent of just a standard black hole collision.
Yeah. I'm surprised it's not that.
Sorry?
I'm just surprised it's that high.
I see.
It is like 3 orders of magnitude, like 4. This is a lot.
What is that number for black holes?
For head-on collisions, the total mass radiated is 1.1% of the total mass.
Here, right.
Here is 14%.
That's 1 order. It's up. From 0.1% to 2 orders. Right.
Mm. 0.1 to 10.
Mathematicians, damage.
Sorry.
But I mean, so all joking aside, why? What's the physical reasoning behind why the boson stars would be so much more effective at emission? Does it have something to do with the choice of the potential? Is a lot of this energy coming out in bosonic field, or you know, what is your feeling for you know, the physical reason why this would be so much more efficient?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think generally this would depend on the potential that you're looking at. One of the reasons as to why these configurations can be producing more energy, well, I guess we have scalar field as well. So we have an additional channel of radiation in the form of the scalar field.
Point, this 14% is measured in gravitational waves, or is measured by comparing the total mass of the random amount with respect to the radiation waves?
No, so this is computed from gravitational waves. So it's just a formula from Psi-4 that you can use.
What is the size of the boson star you want to collide?
What's the size, sorry?
Like the size of your object compared to GM of the object.
Compared to which object, sorry? I see. Okay. So, that's a good question. Depends on what kind of boson star you're looking at. So, if you have a compact star, so these are usually the stars located here, the radius of the star. I'm really worried I'm going to get the number wrong. probably around 4.
Well, you find spot on, isn't it?
Sorry? Yeah, so they definitely have boson stars are not as compact as black holes, so they would have a larger radius. And as you go down this curve, you get less compact stars, and they have even larger radius.
Is this going to be what you're looking for, sorry, I was thinking about something else.
I would suppose the radius would matter when they come, because if you have a star with larger radius, the orbit at which they would come closer to contact each other would be further away because they have a bigger radius. So I think it would definitely play a role, but I don't think anyone quantified that effectively. Yep.
So was I just reading this wrong? Is it actually 0.14%? So it's actually I should multiply that number of times. So it is like similar to black holes.
Will, what did you do to us?
What?
Like as a fraction of the total mass, is it just 0.0014?
Yes. So is it, okay, sorry, I don't know the number by my heart. Okay.
Could I ask another intuition question? Why does the relative phasing of the two stars depend on the mass ratio? Is there an easy way to see why that should be the case?
Yeah, so I think one of the reasons why this is the case is because once you take a binary of unequal mass, they already have a certain dephasing, right? Because they oscillate at different frequencies. So the phase difference that they will kind of encounter at merger will be different. And you further change that by introducing this delta phi constant offset.
So this constant offsets at the initialization of the okay. So
exactly.
If we were to initialize them further away, then this offset might be different because they'll have a different time to merger.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Alrighty. So we've covered the head-on collisions, which are probably pretty boring. So you might ask me, how about more astrophysically significant systems like in spiraling binaries? And before I show you kind of the results, I would like to point out kind of the main components that at least we had to nail down in order to be able to simulate high accuracy in spiraling boson star binaries. So first off, initial data played a role. So remember that we've proposed this improved initial data superposition. And if you were to actually try and simulate an in spiraling boson star binary with plane superposition, your boson stars would have collapsed to a black hole within the quarter of an orbit. Further, we have found that an evolution scheme with damping terms also really helps. So for example, in Geotrombo, we use the CCZ4 formulation that allows for that. We have also encountered some issues with the adaptive mesh refinement. So sometimes poor choices for adaptive mesh refinement can also cause spurious features, like for example, of the two stars departing. I guess the main ingredient of our investigations and allowing us to achieve high accuracy was code comparison. So most of our simulations have been done by two independent code, Geotrombo and Lean. And at least for the simulations that we've considered, we found pretty good agreement. So I realize the parameter space of boson stars can be very overwhelming. So let me limit the data set, what kind of data set we will be looking at. So first off, we will focus on equal mass non-spinning boson stars. And our simulations were separate into two distinct sets. So in the first configuration, we will have two compact stars in spiraling each other. And in the other set, we will have two less compact, or how I like to call them, fluffy stars orbiting each other. And for all of the simulations that we will consider here, we will reduce the eccentricity to fairly low values. So we're interested in quasi-circular orbits. And we also performed a range of simulations with different separations, but we will be targeting kind of waveforms that complete 15 to 20 cycles before merging. So let me start with the first set containing two compact stars. So thanks to the compactness of these stars, we actually form a black hole post-merger. And if you look at the gravitational wave signal, it's characterized by a fairly quasi-circular in spiral, and then the merger and the ring down, which looks very black hole-like. This is as expected as we form a black hole post-merger. Performing convergence tests on these runs, we actually found that we are able to achieve similar accuracies to black hole evolutions, which is good news because we can hopefully do some data analysis for this. To kind of make our signals a little bit more interesting for the compact case, we also investigated some other configurations. So first off, we've considered the anti-boson configuration. So if you recall, for the anti-boson, you have this minus omega parameter, which changes the direction of the rotation in the opposite way. What we see is that actually the signal looks very similar in the early times, but as the two stars approach each other and the separation decreases, the self-interactions become more important. And what we actually see in this inset that there's some sort of oscillatory patterns visible in the signal. And since the stars are still compact, the post-merger remnant is a black hole, so you can see a very black hole-like ring down. Quite interestingly, this signal also exhibits a larger amplitudes in the later in spiral. And if you were to plot this signal over an equal mass black hole waveform, you would actually find a very good agreement. Additionally, we also considered an antiphase configuration. So this corresponded to introducing this delta phi is equal to pi dephasing to one of the stars. And if we isolate the in spiral and just look at the merger, we find something consistent with our head-on collisions, where you can see that at least the peaks of the amplitude around merger are smaller. And the way how this a dephasing and how the repulsive nature of the scalar field is manifested through the in spiral is that actually it delays a black hole formation. So you can see that the antiphase configuration plotted in teal, it's the signal is longer and a black hole forms a little bit later. One thing to highlight here is that these anti-boson, anti-phase effects, they play a role when the stars are very close to each other. If you were to compare the waveforms pretty far away, there is excellent agreement. Finally, I'm coming down to our last set of simulations that we've done. And these are these fluffy configurations. So now we have the equal mass, less compact boson stars orbiting each other. And because they're no longer as compact as the other boson stars we've considered, they actually form a boson star post-merger. And you can see the signal definitely contains non-black hole-like features. And the signal is characterized by a very faint in spiral of order 10 to the minus 6. It's then followed by an immense gravitational wave burst and oscillatory ring down as kind of the boson star remnant settles to a new boson star. And I hopefully I've convinced you that our runs are quasi-circular. As I mentioned before, we have performed eccentricity reductions on these waveforms.
Question, if you look at the frequency of after-merger observations,
yeah.
Is it only by one particular or a few, and what are they tied to?
This is on our to-do list, so we have not done any ring down analysis on this, but I think this is definitely an avenue to explore.
Is the central, the final remnant boson star, is it like a non-spinning one?
Yes, it's a non-spinning one. It's a heavier boson star, so it has a higher central amplitude.
Have you tried to estimate how much radiation there is in the scalar field sector?
No, we have not, no. But I guess that would be an interesting thing to consider as well. We have computed just the overall energy emitted, but we have not isolated the scalar field sector.
But you also computed the amount of energy emitted in gravitational waves and the total?
So we have computed the energy emitted in gravitational waves.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So now that we have our waveforms.
And I have yep. Another question.
Yep.
Any information about the phase, I think, should disappear completely by the formation of the black hole, because it can be interpreted as a hair. Am I right? And if so, how does that information will disappear?
So are you talking the information about the phase as to in these sort of runs where we have the anti-phase configuration, or
the early phase of the two stars? We consider two different phases, right? For the two boson stars.
So we have considered only equal phases and the anti-phase one. We have not explored the parameter space in between.
Okay, any information about these phases will disappear, right? By the formation of the black hole?
Yes, I would expect so, yeah. But
the
black hole forms post-merger, so you no longer have the stars with a certain dephasing.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. Now imagine that there is a hypothetical boson star happening somewhere in our universe, and we want to kind of estimate what is the LIGO response to that. So the idea here is that we're going to take a bunch of waveform approximants that LIGO has. These approximants are usually modeled by some parameters theta. And we want to kind of find the best fit approximant that describes our numerical relativity data. And this comes down to constructing the probability of the model parameters given the data, which is what we call the posterior distribution. And we do that via the Bayes theorem. In order to perform this parameter estimation, we use a special pipeline called Bilby. And the idea here is that we take our NR waveform, we add noise to it, we then ask Bilby to find our waveform and the noise, perform parameter estimation and recovery of the waveform. And additionally, to kind of assess the quality of the recovery, we perform residual analysis. So we define the residual as the difference between the strain seen in the detector and the best fit recovery. And in this case, we take the waveform approximant evaluated at the maximum log likelihood. And if our fit has done well, then we would expect the residual to be compatible with Gaussian noise. So this means that we have fully captured the injected physics and we're essentially done.
So what temperature is it for?
Yeah, I'll answer that in a bit. This is the next slide, thank you. So I don't know how if you're familiar with waveform modeling, but if any of you have tried using these LIGO waveforms, understanding can be very overwhelming. And actually, I would like to bring to your attention this really nice white paper by the LISO waveform group, where they actually detailed all the different waveforms in the different generations, their limitations and capabilities. And for our purposes, we will be focusing on black hole templates. So these are PhenomD, PhenomXP approximants. And we will also consider some in-spiral-only neutron star templates, like, for example, Taylor F2. If these names don't mean anything to you, don't worry. They are not important. all right. So let me now discuss the results. So first, remember that we had these very black hole-like looking signals. So they corresponded to the configurations containing compact stars. And we have performed a range of injections across different total binary masses. And what we have found is that if the total binary mass is large enough, actually the waveform bank can easily recover the waveform, as illustrated in this plot over here, where the injection is in black and the mean reconstructed waveform is in blue. And of course, the residual for this is Gaussian. However, the recovery does not infer the correct injected parameters. Interestingly, the best fit recovery is obtained for the anti-boson configuration. And this is something that I'm trying to demonstrate here in this corner plot, where you can see the pink contours corresponding to just equal phase boson star merges. And the purple one corresponds to the anti-boson configuration. And here we have also shown the injected values in orange. And I mean, the recovery is not perfect, but at least the anti-boson star inference analysis finds that the spins are actually zero, as opposed to the other run, which infers higher spins. And a common feature is that most of the injected parameters do fall at least within the support of the posterior distribution for the anti-boson inference.
So just to be very clear for me, you're injecting mock data generated from a boson star merger, and you're asking, can the LIGO, a LIGO parameter estimation code that assumes only black holes recover accurately something about the system?
Yeah.
And the answer is no, it's biased. This is a mismodeling error of some sort.
It's biased, yeah. So there is definitely some degeneracy. But, I mean, this nicely goes to my, next slide.
Yeah, sorry, can we go to the next slide?
Yep.
I just wanted to ask, so I guess since you're starting at some finite separation, you're starting at some, particular, frequency, and then as you vary the, if you make the masses very large, that might be sort of starting to outside of,
Yes.
And then, as you make them smaller, you might not cover all the frequencies and LIGO sensitivity. So, just roughly, where, I don't know, if you want your signal to start at 10 hertz or something, what maps do you choose or whatever?
So, you can actually enforce the minimum frequency in Bilby. So, even if your waveform does fall below 20 hertz, you can still enforce 20 hertz in your analysis. But for the most of the runs that we've considered, actually, our starting frequency is somewhere around 20 hertz, and it's even a little bit larger. So,
okay.
Yeah.
But then I guess somehow there would be like for real, like if you signal, there would be some more signal that you're not injecting just because you haven't injected that receiver machine. But that's,
right.
So it wouldn't be that sensitive if it's infrasound.
Yeah, if I remember the PSD of the LIGO curve correctly, it has a bump just a little bit further down from 20 hertz. Uh-huh. So the sensitivity around 20 hertz will be slightly less.
But shouldn't Bilby be taking all that into account with the size of the contours?
No, I'm just saying like because the simulation starts at some frequency, if you don't include the signal before, like,
right.
You know, whether
that would protect or not. So piggybacking on David's question, I mean, you know, it's biased because you know there's a bias because you know what you inject is, but we have all these are black holes.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying some boats maybe it's be something else. But that I guess you could only what if that's kind of a scenario,
mm-hmm.
what would you do? Can you look at some of these and have best fit to look at what the residual is telling you? Is there anything, is there a smoking gun that says, well, you detected it, but you don't know what it is?
So you can get smoking gun effects that I will explain in my further slides. But for at least these sort of configurations where you consider high total masses of the binary, you definitely get a degeneracy with a black hole waveform. And I mean, by no means, I'm not claiming that whatever we have detected is a boson star merger. Coming down to the smoking gun effects. So actually, our recoveries have shown that black hole waveforms kind of start to fail to recover binaries of smaller total masses. And one of the reasons is that when you decrease the total binary mass, your in spiral becomes more significant to the rest of the signal. So now what we're asking Bilby to do is to fit for the whole signal. Before, our signal was mainly dominated by the latent spiral and the merger. And unfortunately, in these circumstances, Bilby fails and it produces a non-Gaussian residual. So we have not fully captured our physics. And here is an example of a recovery. And you can see that Bilby is trying to fit a few cycles here. But because it's actually inferring processing spins, which are actually visible in the waveform, I mean, the whole analysis goes wrong. Finally, I would like to touch up on some of the results that we have obtained from analyzing our fluffy runs. So here we have focused on in spiral only neutron star waveforms to recover our signal. And surprisingly, we've actually found that a simple Taylor F2 approximant can recover the in-spiral pretty well. And it even leaves a Gaussian residual. However, once again, the injected parameters are not perfectly recovered. So there's definitely some sort of degeneracy there. However, we are limited to the in-spiral content of the waveform. And I hope these degeneracies can be disentangled by looking at the ring down of our fluffy configurations, which, if you recall, had these very distinct oscillatory patterns. And this brings me to the conclusion slide. I don't know if I have any time left.
I think we are at time, if you just want to comment
yep.
on your conclusions.
Cool. So I think there are three main things I would like you to take out from this talk. So first thing is that something as niche as initial data can actually impact numerical relativity simulation significantly. And I hope I have managed to show you certain regimes where boson star signals can differ from signals that we see from black holes and neutron stars. And finally, I guess I have also convinced you that we can do high precision numerical relativity simulations. We're not there yet because we've just explored a very tiny portion of our parameter space, but I hope high-precision numerical relativity simulations can help us with more accurate waveform models for boson stars. Yeah, thank you.
I think there are- a lot of questions during the talk, so I think we're running a little bit late. Maybe we have time for one or two questions, and then we'll carry on informally afterwards.
Wait a quick question. So in the previous two cases, can you just remind me what's like the SMR of the signal once you inject it?
So for all of the injection studies that we did, we aimed to have fairly high SNR values of roughly 30, okay. At least in the Hanford detector. For Livingston, it would be slightly lower.
Another quick question to add is you quoted some titles of probability parameter, and I guess that's what the waveform model like extracted. Is there a calculation for boson star members taking the credit?
Good question. So actually, this one is exactly the tidal Love number that you can compute for a single boson star solution. So this is roughly of 1,000 for those fluffy stars that we're considering. But what Bilby is inferring is actually a way larger tidal Love numbers of, 4,000.
Oh, I see.
And I mean, you can see it's probably very small, but I can tell you that, these lines show the 90% confidence level, and the upper and the lower limits are ballpark 600, so it doesn't even cover 1,000.
So let me invoke a host's prerogative and ask.
I have not.
Oh.
Go ahead. Go ahead. I should have asked earlier, but here you're fine-tuning the parameters of your potential such that these are right size as the similar size of black holes that the black hole sees. Is that true?
No, so we have not fine-tuned the size of the stars. We just fixed our potential, and we decided that, we're going to take the extreme part of our potential.
But the parameters of the potential are chosen such a size of these, or I can mix any size, are you saying, without potential?
So the size would differ, depending what model you take from the potential. We've taken the extreme one corresponding to a compact star, so it's kind of the smallest one that you can get, but it's not as compact as a black hole. It's a
No, but I'm asking about a length scale because these are dimensional parameters that could be to you.
Right. So are you asking what are the masses we've considered for these stars, or?
But I'm thinking, do you have to fine-tune the parameter and the potential so that the size of these boson stars are the size of the stellar mass black holes? If I take the mass of this scalar, so I guess you had the mass parameter and mu naught and mu naught, like that.
Right, but you have the freedom in scaling it with the mass. So once you find your a boson star solution, you can scale the mass term and the potential in order to obtain a certain astrophysical mass, say of like 40 solar mass.
But the mass is fixed by some particle physics model. You cannot just change it.
Actually the mass range for that scalar field in the potential mu is fairly broad. So I think I've put the, where is it? I've put the range here. It might not be fully accurate, but it can be very ultralight, or it can go to slightly higher values. And by tweaking this mu, you can control the mass, the astrophysical mass of your boson star.
Right. So for it to be comparable to the LIGO black hole, you need a particular mu.
Yes. And it's actually, if I recall the number correctly, I think for us, this mu is roughly 10 to the minus 12, or something like that.
All right. With that, let's thank Tamara again.